choice. You picked it. You voted.
Saturday, yeah, this Saturday.
That's what y'all voted for. That's what y'all gonna get.
Tyler, Brandon, David, Brandon, Ryan, Chad, Ernest. All right, cool. This is here. He is here. Wyatt's here.
All right, so the exam will open up at 8 o'clock in the morning. It will remain open until 11:59 p.m. You can do it at any point during the day. Up to you.
Multiple choice, 30 questions, two essays within. Within the essay questions are individual separate essays that you can choose. There's like three or four in each. You only have to answer one. So basically, you pick which essay you want to answer. The first technical essay counts for 10 points on the 100-point scale. The second, technically, is extra credit. As you will see as we go forward, you don't get like a percentage or a letter grade in Engage. You get the raw number. That's because I want to give you an extra credit. And unfortunately, with the system, I can't program one question to be an extra credit. So if you get the first essay when it appears, if you don't want to answer any of those, it's fine, skip it, go and do the next one. Doesn't matter to me, but make sure you answer one, because, I mean, ultimately it's 10 points. I mean, I think you would want to try answering both, but...
What's the time limit?
An hour. You have 60 minutes to do it. One question will appear on the screen at a time. The exam is completely randomized. So even if you're sitting next to somebody, they will see a different question than you will. Answers will also be jumbled up. You cannot go back. So you can do one question at a time. You work your way through it meticulously. If you skip anything, it's wrong. No going back. Yes?
Are the extra credits due like by the end of Saturday?
If you're going to do any of the extra credit work, which are the chapter reviews, and I think we've done about three chapters for the first exam, yeah, you got to get those to me by the end of Saturday at some point. If you're doing any of the extra credit stuff, you're going to email it to me. Send it to me in an email. Other questions? Wait, Ashley, you were here last class, right?
Yeah, I was.
Why can I skip you? And Cameron, you were here last class also. Although both of you do have one absence, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Let me see. One, two, three, four, five of you have absences, which is not good, but that means the rest of you are still on track to get extra credit at the end for having perfect attendance.
So keep it up. All right. So I think that's all I got to say about the exams, unless you have any other questions.
We can find out in Engage, sir.
It's in Engage, yeah. It's down toward the bottom. Make sure you are on a stable Wi-Fi, place that is stable Wi-Fi, because if you get kicked out for any reason, you can't go back and do it again. I may let you do a retake, but you'll have to start from scratch. It's just the way the system is. It's wonky. If you get kicked out, you can't go back in and start the exam again. So I know there's issues on campus, so if your dorm is Wi-Fi wise, you know, go to the library or something like that. Find a place where Wi-Fi is stable. Okay? Any other questions? You do one essay from each question. So if you open up an essay and there's four questions in there, you pick one. And you only answer one. If you try answering more than one, that's fine, but I'm going to grade the first one regardless of what it is. So then at some point, the second one will open up and you can decide, do I want to do a second essay? If you do, obviously the first essay will count for the first 10 points. The second one will be extra credit. So in theory, it's possible to get a perfect score on this exam of 110. That's the highest points you can get, yes.
So on Saturday, is it going to be posted or is it already posted?
It's in engage. It just will open up. Okay. The exams are down at the bottom. I got to program the right data because I think I have it set for like 2025 or something like that. But yeah, I will fix it. I will do that either tonight or tomorrow. You'll get a notice that I made a change to it, and that will let you know that it will be there. And then at 8 o'clock in the morning, if you're up and you've had your coffee, you can jump right in and do it, or you can wait all the way till 11:59. But don't go beyond 11:59 because the system will shut you out.
Where can I find your extra credit assignments?
It's in the chapter review questions in the textbook. Okay. I talked about that on the syllabus review video. So the book, that's the textbook. You open it up, you go all the way through the first chapter. At the end, there's usually like four basic questions, and then there's like four harder questions. You'll get a point for every question you answer, so long as you answer what's asked. And you can get a half a point if you do the definitions, because there's like 10 terms or 12 terms per chapter. So theoretically, for every single chapter, you have the ability to make somewhere between 15 points extra credit. And if you remember from the syllabus review video, every 5 points is equal to adding 1 point to your final average. So just by doing one chapter, you have the ability to add a third of a grade point to your overall average. And those points stay with you all semester long. So obviously, the more chapters you do, the more extra credit you can get. And that's the reason why I did say on the video, there are people who do it all and end up adding like 30 points to their final average. It's possible. Possible. So if you end the semester with an F, it's not on me. We can blame my weaker. It's his fault. Any other questions? You good? Okay. Of course, if you think of anything else, let me know. All right. So we're going to finish up this colonization stuff, the Age of Exploration. It did continue. It continued beyond the Columbuses and the Portuguese. It continued when the English went out, and then the Dutch went out, and the French went out. And they largely did the same thing that the Spanish had done, but they just did it in other parts of the world. The biggest challenge, though, was the Europeans' desire to essentially penetrate the Asian trade networks. Initially, the Dutch and the English followed along the same basic lines of the Portuguese. So they didn't look to take land, but rather they looked to control the flow of goods. Bless you. But eventually, there was a gradual shift where the Europeans decided, you know something, having territory in Asia is not a bad thing. But it was complicated. And again, it took decades for them to decide. The biggest reason was unlike the Portuguese or the Spanish, whose explorers sailed for the crown, when the Dutch came over, when the British came over, even the French, it wasn't the government, it wasn't the crown that was controlling them, but rather businesses, joint stock trading companies. The mercantilist game had changed. Instead of the crown controlling it, they gave out licenses to businesses who came out and did the let's get more money, more land for the good of the crown. So there was a profit incentive. If the businesses like the British East India Company were successful, they could make lots of profit, and then the shareholders would also make profit. But because they were businessmen, they didn't want to get involved in wars. They wanted money. Why? Well, it's money that makes the world go round. It really is. So the directors of the companies basically told their employees, don't get us in wars. Wars cost money. Don't try to take over land. That costs money. Focus on the business. Get the goods from the producers, put it on your ship, sail it to market. But in the age before You had the ability to pick up a device that operates on minerals that are mined by little African children and put together by little Chinese children. Slave labor goes into your phones, by the way. So if you use phones, don't ever complain about slaves, because the little Africans are still enslaved in Africa, going underground, getting those rare earth minerals out, and there are Chinese slaves that build these. All you gotta do is do a quick Google search for the footage of the apple factories, where they actually have to put bars on the windows to stop the Chinese from killing themselves to get out of work. It's bad. So don't complain about slaves, though, if you like your phones. But anyways, before there were phones, and you had the ability to literally pick it up and dial, you could talk to someone on the other side of the earth instantly. The agents for the companies were on the other side of the world. And it could take months for word to go one way. So what happened were the agents of the companies on the other side of the earth slowly started engaging in what we could call intrigue. Shenanigans. It's our opportunity for them to make money. So instead of staying out of politics like they were told to, they began doing the exact opposite. They soon learned how to manipulate events so that way they could make money. They observed, particularly in the islands, that the ruling systems were based on tribal structure, and usually it was the eldest male who was the most powerful that would be the ruler. But when the ruler died, there was no primogeniture. That's a really fancy word that I don't expect you to remember. But unlike everywhere else on Earth, Europe practiced primogeniture, which means the oldest son follows the father. So in England, whoever the oldest kid was, that's who's going to become the next king. There was no question. That was the law. But everywhere on Earth, there was no such rules. So pretty much it was whichever son could put together the biggest army and lay claim to the old man's throne. So what these ancients started doing is going up to all of the different princes and basically saying, hey, if I help you get in power, what can you do for me? And ultimately, this is what allowed these European trading companies to begin penetrating. Take, for example, the Dutch East India Company, the Dutch Trading Company. One of the things that they did, similar to what the Portuguese did, was they focused on locations. They decided the best thing that they can do is get into these locations, and then they can control the flow of goods in and out of the region. And once they were in, they were kind of doing what the Portuguese were doing. So they would make contact with a local chieftain, and they would get permission to get license to carry certain products, and they would attempt to monopolize the flow of those goods to market. But they fanned out. They established trading relations as far away as with Japan. But they weren't producing things. They were bringing goods that were produced by the natives on the Asian trade network. But unlike the Portuguese, the Dutch were smarter. They were smarter. They made two very important decisions, learning from the mistakes of the Portuguese. The first thing they didn't do was use force. They didn't act like bullies like the Portuguese did. They didn't use threats of bombardment to get what they wanted. Instead, they focused on that gentlemanly handshake. So if they made a promise, they fulfilled the promise.
The second thing that they didn't do was they didn't push religion. The Portuguese, being Catholics, brought Catholicism with them. And they tried forcing the cross upon the natives.
But by the time the Dutch arrived, they had become Protestants. And they weren't interested in proselytizing, preaching.
So they could focus just on business. And in the end, FYI, that's one of the reasons why the Dutch would remain present in Asia all the way up until post-World War II. They had control of Indonesia, for example, all the way into the late 1950s. With little to no uprisings, little to no having to use force. They just engaged in business.
But they also would create systematic monopoly systems. So they made the contact with the local farmer. The local farmer promised to give all his crop to the Dutch merchant, and the Dutch merchant sailed it to whatever the next point was. And when they arrived, say, in China, they made relations with the Chinese, and they promised to pick up all of the Chinese goods and then bring the Chinese goods to the next market.
They didn't want to allow, say, the Muslim traders, the merchants, to get onto this side of the Pacific Rim. And in the end, they made fabulous wealth. Fabulous wealth. Here's one of the best little pieces of business advice that I can give you from a non-businessman. If you ever decide to open up a store, I don't care who comes through your door. I don't care what they look like. I don't care how they perceive themselves. There's only one color that's important. And that's green.
You want that customer to give you all of the money they're willing to give you. Because you're not in business to do politics. You're not in business to be an activist. You're not in business to discriminate. You're in business to make money.
And that was one of the things the Dutch proved. They didn't care who the heck they were. Little primitive natives with little bones through their noses and plates, you know, embedded into their lips. They didn't care. What do you have for me? Let's do business.
Now, coincidentally, the English would learn from the Dutch.
And that's one of the reasons why the English in time would take over all of India. They didn't worry about religion. They didn't worry about culture. All they focused on was money.
Questions?
So how did they do it? How did they actually penetrate and get in and take over? Well, ironically, the easiest model to follow is the basis that would allow the Dutch to take over eventually all of Indonesia, when they focused on taking over the first island that they essentially would, I don't want to say conquer, because they didn't conquer it.
They just took it over, and that would be the island right here of Java.
Located on Java was one of the most powerful of the island capitals, the city of Jakarta. And Java was also the most populous island on Indonesia. So it was the most people there. And it had the capacity of producing a commodity that everybody on the Asian trade network wanted. Hence the nickname for the island, Java, coffee.
So the Dutch basically said, yeah, I want to get in. I want to take this over.
But how do you do it? Well, in 1619, the first agents of the Dutch East India Company arrived and would negotiate with the rulers, and the rulers would allow the Dutch to make a factory
in the northwest corner of the island, the tiny little village of Batavia, located just beyond Jakarta. I can't get the dot there. There we go, right about where that red dot is, right in the middle.
They would be allowed to build their warehouse. The local chieftain would allow them to engage with islanders. And if any of the islanders wanted to do business with the Dutch, they'd be allowed. So long as the Dutch treated the people respectfully. But here's the quid pro quo. The expectation was, if the ruler allows you to set up shop, you obey the ruler. You're a vassal. And the Dutch willingly agreed to do so. So, if the ruler wanted taxes paid, the Dutch paid their taxes. If the ruler wanted the Dutch to carry some, go get some goods for him, the Dutch did it. Whatever the ruler asked, the Dutch complied with. And in many ways, they started acting just as if they were other islanders. But from this base of operations, they slowly began going out and making contact with other island populations. And soon, they would be given monopolies over the transportation of goods from the islands. So if an island made a particular spice, only the Dutch could come and get it. But again, they weren't like the Portuguese, where they threatened to destroy and kill and murder. No. We'll give you the best price. We'll do the best business for you. But all the while, their factory is getting fuller and fuller and fuller. Should be civil war. I don't know where the war is. Maybe the war's back here somewhere. Fast forward 50 years of doing good, solid business, and a dispute breaks out amongst the different princes who want to take control of the throne. Each of the princes make promises to the Dutch. Hey, look, if you help me, because the Dutch have guns, if you help me, I'll give you more land. I'll give you more perks. I'll lower taxes for you. You know, quid pro quo. Coincidentally, after solid negotiations, the Dutch begin to pick the winners. Whoever the Dutch side with wins the civil war. And in exchange, the winner fulfills their promises to the Dutch. They're allowed to open up multiple factories. They're allowed to start taking control of some or more of the major ports. They're given their blessing to take over more of the 1,000-plus islands that make up the Indonesian archipelago. Quid pro quo. But in order to grow their strength, because the Dutch people come from halfway around the earth, what the Dutch then did was very clever. They started hiring locals to serve in a proto-military force. They're given Dutch guns. They're allowed to wear Dutch uniforms. They're taught the language. And they're commanded by Dutch officers. Despite the fact that there's only a few hundred Dutch citizens over here, by 1700, the Dutch are able to raise armies, thousands in numbers. Because who doesn't like wearing a uniform? I mean, for the islanders, the natives, oh yeah, they get to wear a uniform. They get to walk around with authority. Well, needless to say, you keep going forward over the decades. Whenever there are more disputes, the Dutch deploy their military forces and help the next ruler take control. And all you do is repeat. By the 1750s, the Dutch, for all sakes and purposes, had complete control over Java and about 200 of the islands. They didn't have to conquer. They didn't have to subjugate. They didn't do what the Spanish did to the Inca or the Aztecs. They just played local politics. They picked the winner, and they were rewarded for their efforts. And in the end, the Dutch were able to take control of Indonesia, and like I said, they controlled it up until the 1950s. Never had to face an insurrection, never had to face a revolution. Questions? Yeah. Because they didn't really force it upon the people. You know, the people who are from South America, Central America, they all speak Spanish because the Spanish forced the language on them. Yeah. Unless you are from Brazil or one of the islands, you know, that the Portuguese controlled in the Caribbean, then in that instance you spoke Portuguese. Because that language was forced upon them. But in Indonesia, it was never forced on them. If you wanted to speak your local language, you could still speak your local tribal language. That was fine. The Dutch could afford to hire interpreters. But there was no cultural repression, as was the case with what the Spanish did. And that's the reason why today there is still a strong, vibrant culture in Indonesia, whereas in Central and South America, it's just a bastardized form of the Spanish culture. All right. Now, in terms of takeover, the Brits would do the same thing, but they had a much bigger target in mind. In time, following the same basic methods that the Dutch used, the Brits would end up taking over the entire subcontinent of India. And how did they do it? Well, they would do exactly the same thing. There would be disputes that would emerge, politics amongst local chieftains who are known as Rajas. And the British East India Company would play favorites in exchange for land grants. Like the Dutch, they also would build a native army known as sepoys. But the sepoys, the force that the Brits would put together, dwarfed in comparison the size of the forces that the Dutch put together. They would have tens of thousands of men, hundreds of thousands. Although, interestingly enough, the Brits would use the sepoys also as a foreign army. When we start talking about the Brits' intervention in China during the Opium Wars, and I'm going to say, for example, the Brits sent 20,000 soldiers. Those 20,000 are all sepoys. So they actually had Indians, natives of India, that would wear British red coats, and they would go on the battlefield and fight under the British flag. Sepoys would also be deployed in Africa and the Middle East. And in my World War I class, when we get to 1915, I have a really funny picture of a bunch of Hindus from India in the Western trenches, the trenches that exist in that were in Belgium at the time. In fact, the Sepoy force there was one of the force units to get gassed by the Germans. But it's something you would never think of. Well, this is one of the strengths that the British were able to build. This is what allowed them to become a global empire. They harvest the vast population of India and put it to war for them. But there also is a big difference. When the Dutch took over Indonesia, there was no competition. There was no one else there. But in India, they were actually competing against the French, who were trying to do the same thing as the British were. So the key for the Brits was they basically had to give a better deal to the Rajas than the French could provide. All right. So here's how they did it. Here's how they did it. They would begin going into one of the dozens of major provinces. And I'm going to focus on just the province of Bengal, because the takeover of Bengal was the area on which the British would ultimately make most of the money that they made in the short term. Bengal is this province here that's in between India and Laos and Southeast Asia. The Brits would arrive in the province in 1690. Now at the time, as we're going to see, much of India was actually controlled by the Mughals. We'll talk about that for the second exam. The Mughals was a Muslim dynasty. So you had a minority population, the Muslims, controlling the majority population of Hindu. The emperor, when the Brits arrived, was a guy by the name of Aurangzeb, who we're going to see as being one of the most brutal of all of the Mughal rulers, if you were a Hindu. So, why am I mentioning this? Well, there was an interesting dynamic going on. The vast majority of the people were Hindu. They were controlled by Muslims. Now you have these Christians coming in. Well, the local ruler, the local governor, ruling in the name of Aurangzeb, would allow the Brits to come in. And the East India Company would set up access here. I don't know if I get the red dot going. Down here. Along a riverbed, the Bengali River, at a place where there were three small villages. The governor gave the whole region to the Brits, all three towns. Instead of having three separate towns, however, the British East India Company would merge the towns together and refer to it as Calcutta. And in the middle of Calcutta, they made a factory that was called Fort William. From 1698 all the way up until 1756, the Brits and the local chieftain, the ruler, a Nawab, got along fine. The ruler of the province, well, there's the dot right there, allowed the Brits to do whatever they wanted. The Brits paid taxes. They focused on business. They didn't push religion. Everything was fine. Up until 1756. In 1756, the Nawab, the local ruler, the governor, a man by the name of Siraj Uz Dalah, suddenly changed his mind. He decided he didn't want the Brits there anymore. He wanted the French there. Because the French apparently gave him better terms, better deals. So, in an act of outright betrayal, Siraj Ud Dalah orders his soldiers to move against the Brits. They march into Calcutta. They seize Fort William and arrest all of the British agents, except for one who managed to get out. Well, when word spread what Siraj had done, the British East India Company, acting on its own right, it didn't go to the government, it didn't go to the crown, it didn't ask for its blessing. Instead, it took actions into its own hands. It organized a sepoy force and moved it into battle position to take Fort William back. This set the stage for one of the most famous British battles in their eventual conquest of all of India, the Battle of Plassey. Amazing story. Wish I had time to go into all the details, but I don't. Very simple. The commander, Robert Clive, organizes a sepoy force of about 3,000 and moved into battle position in hopes of drawing the army of Siraj Ud Dalah out onto the battlefield. Now, the Brits were outnumbered more than 10 to 1. The Nawab, deployed an army of about 50,000 strong, mostly Muslims, under the command of French officers. I mention that because the British East India Company sepoys were Hindu. Well, here's the funny thing. Siraj uses his French-trained Muslims and would attempt to fight a European-style battle. So if you know anything about warfare in the 1800s, guys were firing muskets, smoothbore, muzzle-loading muskets. So you'd have them march in block units. They'd march up close to the enemy, position yourself, and then open fire at short, close range. 50,000 to 3,000. It was not even by any measurement. It appeared that the Nawab and his French-trained forces were going to sweep the battlefield of these Hindus. Oh. But in comes the brilliance of Sir Robert Clive. Clive had taken time to learn the local dynamics of the culture. He understood that the Hindus were the majority of the population and that they were pushing back on the brutality of the Muslims. And ultimately, they wanted to regain their autonomy. So, Clive makes lots of connections with local Hindu bankers who give money freely to Clive. Clive then takes the cash and essentially buys Siraj's primary general, a guy by the name of Mir Jafar, as well as other key allies. So when the battle begins, 50,000 march out, get into position, but all of the troops, which was most of the army, commanded by Mir Jafar, when the word goes out to charge, turn around and walk off the battlefield, leaving Siraj, his troops, only a few thousand. And when the traitors' forces were well out of way, the Brits opened fire with artillery. They brought cannon in, and nobody knew. So they started firing cannon blasts down at the Muslim soldiers, who were ripped to shreds. Siraj was outraged, marched into Mir Jafar's tent, demanding an explanation. To which Mir Jafar basically said, "It's all about the Benjamins. It's all about the Benjamins. The Brits paid more." So he arrests Siraj ud-Dawla, later executes him. He actually killed him with his own hands. And as a reward, Clive declares Mir Jafar is now going to be the ruler of the entire province of Bengal. He named him Nawab. Little quid pro quo. Essentially, making him a puppet. The Rajas, the local leaders that were owned by the British, would become known as British Rajas. Almost like an insult. Because, again, depending upon your opinion, they essentially sell out their own people. But what would you do for the power to control a province that you had no right to control in big bags of gold coins? What would you do? Oh, no, I'm going to fight on principle. It's wrong. Hell no. What would you do for Klondike Bar? What would you do for a big bag of gold coins? I know what I'd do. Sign me up. I could use that coat. I mean, look at it. He's wearing bling. I'm sure that's silk. I mean, come on now. I'd be okay with that. That'd be all right with me. But what eventually happened, Mir Jafar began giving more and more rights and grants to the British. And by the time of Mir Jafar's passing of natural causes, when the Brits picked his successor, they had complete control over the entire province, economically speaking. Now, multiply that by every single major province on India, and in part that's the reason why by 1850, the Brits would control everything. They didn't conquer it like the Spanish did. No, they simply bought the local leaders. And they maintained control by hiring local soldiers. And the natives allowed this to happen. Willingly. Because of money. Opportunity. Another thing that helped was by the time they began really asserting themselves, they also manipulated that Islamic Hindu division. The Muslims were on retreat. The Hindus wanted to get rid of the Muslims. So the Hindus willingly signed up and joined with the Brits. Because the Brits would not force religion upon them. Because the Brits were focused on money. They would, in time, establish three major centers of business operation. Bombay is there, Calcutta's over there, and where's Madras? Oh, Madras is right there. So, out of Bombay, ships would be loaded, and after the Brits would take over the Suez Canal, cargo vessels, dozens at a time, would sail out and make their way up to the Persian Gulf, sail up through the Suez Canal and go all the way over to England. But goods from China came in and entered Madras there, or maybe came into Calcutta. But from these three points, all of the goods that were raised or harvested or produced would eventually flow to one of these major ports. And the Brits would have complete economic control. Another reason why the Hindus did not resist, and by the way, the same is true with how the Brits and the French, and then the Germans and the Dutch and other people would take control of Africa in the late 19th century, early 20th century. This is because locals sold their people out because there was no sense of national identity. For the local Hindu, he didn't view himself as an Indian. He didn't view himself as anything other than just a person who happened to live in town. And if you're just a person living in a town and someone gives you a job offer where you can make money and take care of your family, are you not going to do it? Again, don't try playing the high and mighty. I would never do that in that circumstance. I would never sell my people out. Okay, sure. But I kid you not, by the mid-19th century, England had so complete of control over India that this would become the pivot point in their global empire. At the very same time they lose those 13 Atlantic colonies in North America, they gain control of the subcontinent and of India. And they would use it as not only a source for investment, but also a place to take out key cash crops. Cotton in particular, but sugar cane, coffee, tea, and even later, opium. Key commodity that the Brits would extract out of India. Opium. Wait till we see how the Brits used opium to bring China to its knees. But, again, we don't have time to talk everywhere on Earth where they penetrated, but in a nutshell, this is how by World War I, the European powers basically controlled the world. Any place that hadn't broken away and declared their independence, like what would happen in Mexico and Central and South America, but places like Africa would all be carved up this way. The Middle East, you know, once the Ottoman Empire fell, same thing. This is how they maintained control of India. It's how they got into Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and eventually even China. They would topple the imperial system. Not by sending armies and conquering, by focusing on economics. Questions? All right, last but not least, we cannot ignore the fact that, yes, Christianity also would be spread into places like Africa and into Asia. But not to the extent as to what the Spanish and the Portuguese did over in the New World. Again, I'm not trying to be derogatory. I'm just stating a simple fact. They completely wiped out the native populations. Wiped out the native culture. If you have family that comes from the Caribbean or from South America or from Central America, Yeah, maybe go back 500 years ago, you might have a relative or an ancestor who was a native, but that culture was destroyed. It was completely destroyed, and your people were assimilated into European culture. You're probably a Catholic, you speak Spanish, or you speak Portuguese. It just is. It's funny. I have good friends from Haiti. And physically, they look like they should come from Africa, but they don't. Because at some point, their ancestors were sold to a Portuguese or a Spanish merchant, and they were brought over and they replaced the native population. Catholics, speak Spanish, good people. But in their mind, they're Haitian or the Dominican. They don't know any different. Because it was complete. That's how successful the Spanish were and the Portuguese were. In Asia, not as much. Not as much. The biggest reason is that the nations that were the most successful, economically speaking, they had no interest in proselytizing. The Dutch, the English, they were Protestants. They practiced a form of Calvinism, which of course is rooted in the concept of predestination. In other words, you can't convert and become a Catholic. You're born to be a Catholic. So the Dutch and the English, they're focused on money. They had no interest in converting the natives to the faith. No interest. They wanted money. They didn't care if you were a Muslim. They didn't care if you were a Hindu. They didn't care what you were. A Buddhist. Let's do business. But we also can't forget that the Portuguese and the Spanish did go over to Asia as well. And into Africa. And they did bring with them that missionary zeal. But unlike the New World, where their victory was complete, in Asia, not really. Part of the reasons why is because when the Portuguese and the Spanish came, Islam was already here. And particularly in the docks, the port cities, you know, there was a significant Islamic presence. And then when you penetrated inland, you had, like in India, for example, you had the Hindu faith. Very complex religion. We'll talk a little bit about it when we get into India. But the most important thing about the Hindu system is they believe in what's known as a caste system. Anyone know anything about Hinduism? Well, Brahmanism, as it's technically should be known as. Their society, even to this day, even though the caste system was made illegal, it's still quietly in place in India. Basically, you're born into a group, a caste, your family. And that caste, that group that you're born into, determines what you're going to do for a job. Your career is determined by your caste. Where you live is determined by the caste that you're born into. Literally, who you are allowed to have any type of relations with, even just friends, all determined by the caste system. If you are born in one of the upper castes, you are the equivalent of a noble. You have extra rights, privileges, authority. But everyone below you is considered like a peon. Whereas if you're born in a low class, you better look down when someone of the higher caste goes by, because the person who's the higher caste can basically beat you up. Now, how bad is it? Well, I happen to, wouldn't really call them friends, but I know an Indian couple that moved into town, and they moved to America fleeing the caste system because the woman comes from a lower caste than her husband. And under tradition, the husband and the wife were in arranged marriages, partners picked by their parents, not by themselves. And they didn't want to get involved in this arranged marriage. And they didn't want to get married to the people who their parents picked. They fell in love with each other. So the only way they could do it was literally to migrate. They did it legally. Come to America. Because we don't have a caste system over here. Well, here's the thing. Not only is the Hindu faith very complicated, rigid, but under the caste system, someone from an upper class would never convert to a religion whose message is aimed at the low people. I mean, let's be honest. Who is Christianity actually geared towards? Who does Jesus, who did Jesus talk about? Sinners. Well, sinners. Who else did Jesus talk about? The low, the meek, the hungry, the desperate, the tired. Well, if you're from an upper caste system, you're never going to convert to this religion that's going to say that you're going to be equal with someone who you perceive to be inferior of you. So the rigidity of the culture actually prevented Christianity from penetrating India, unlike what it did in Central and South America, where simply it allowed everything that was there to be wiped away. But that's not to say that there weren't missionaries that tried. For example, the missionary Francis Xavier, Jesuit, he actually went to India. He managed to convert tens of thousands, but mostly poor people. He had no success with middle or upper classes. And when he was recalled, in the end, his mission would soon, over several decades, simply just disappear. It was not sustainable. Now, there was another Jesuit that tried going to the top caste and hopefully using this structure to do like a top-down conversion, like what the Catholics did when they came to the Inca Empire or the Aztec Empire. One of the leading Jesuits was a man by the name of Robert de Nobly. He decided, instead of preaching to the poor, he was going to try to start hobnobbing with the upper classes. But to do so, he had to learn the language. So he learned Sanskrit. And then once he could communicate, he began reading the sacred Brahma texts, like the Rig Veda. He did so to try to find commonalities, but he couldn't find any. And soon, he lost himself in the ancient Hindu texts. A very rich, diverse stories that focus on winning the favor of the gods by making offerings and engaging in chants, ritualistic chants and dances and so forth. Soon, he got rid of his Christian robes and started wearing the garments worn by the Hindu priests. Again, wool versus silk. Just saying. Bless you. He also became a vegetarian. Because they don't eat meat in India. The cow is a sacred animal. But in the end, he was unsuccessful. He found himself assimilated into Hindu culture rather than vice versa. So in the end, I think it was like 1660, the Pope got word that he was essentially becoming a Hindu priest, so he recalled him. and forbade him from ever going back to India or preaching anything to do with India. Because he could not spread the faith. He lost his faith. But while the Catholics failed in India, they would have one area of complete success. And that would be the island nation of the Philippines. The reason being, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism never got to the Philippines. It was still primarily pagan and primitive. So the Spanish unleashed a missionary campaign, spearheaded by local priests, friars, who would go out and meet with tribal leaders and would attempt to engage in the top-down conversions. So if you could convert the chief would then tell the nobles to convert, who would then tell the people to convert. The friars would also serve as agents of Spain, government officials of sort. But one of the biggest successes in the Philippines came from the fact that once the local leaders converted, they allowed the friars to build right in the center of town a local church. That church, right in the middle of the town, would not only be where the friars lived, would not only serve as government offices, but it would be soon become the heart of the community. And people began going to church, looking for the blessings of the friars. And here is where the friars had their biggest success. Instead of trying to eradicate local cultures, local traditions, the Spanish friars were allowed to blend some Filipino customs with Catholic beliefs. For example, one of the big things that are part of Asian cultures is ritualistic bathing. There are certain holidays where everyone is supposed to basically go down to the river, or go down to the lake, or go down to the ocean, and the whole community is supposed to jump in and clean themselves, spiritually speaking. Well, there's nothing about ritualistic bathing in Catholicism. But the friars had no problem with it, so they allowed it to stay. So now there's actually some Catholic holidays that are celebrated in the Philippines that start off with communal bathing. They also allowed ritualistic drinking. One of the things that apparently were big in traditional Filipino culture was at certain times when you're going to remember a departed ancestor, you're supposed to have a drink with them. Well, the friars like making beer and stuff, the Trappist monks. So they just, hey, woo, let's have some drinks. Let's have some wine with our dinner. Nothing wrong with that. And they were allowed to keep their family shrines. Another important aspect of Asian culture. You're literally supposed to worship your ancestors. Your ancestors are supposed to be your guardian angels of sorts. Well, the friars allowed the Filipinos to continue to worship their ancestors. It was no big deal. And as a result, Filipinos today are some of the most devoted Catholics on earth. And the example that I give every single year of this is coming up soon. Any of you ever see the footage that comes out of the Philippines in and around Easter? Anyone have any idea what I'm talking about? What's Easter in the church tradition?
It's when Christ was risen.
Mm. Risen from what?
The dead.
He died. How did he die?
He died on the cross.
He died on the cross for the sins of man. In the Philippines, on every single major island, there is always a single volunteer who volunteers to allow themselves to become crucified. We're not talking, well, let's just tie them up. No, no. They literally get nailed to the cross. They literally get raised up and they sit there for several hours in agonizing pain. But they do that as a symbol of their faith because they believe in the sacrifice that Jesus made. Of course, they're not lanced and then, you know, taken down. They are taken down. But how strong is your faith? Would you allow someone to get a hammer and a spike and spike you to a cross? I love God. Love Jesus. But the idea of me willingly allowing myself to get crucified, I don't know if I'm up on that. But these people are devout. And they are devout because it was not forced upon them. They were brought in and they were allowed to retain local aspects. So, whereas they failed everywhere else, the Catholics were most successful in the Philippines for the same reason why the Brits and the Dutch were most successful economically. We're not going to force our way in values. Bring you along. And ultimately, that's how the Asian trade network would fall to the Dutch, to the English, and the French. Questions? Oh no, I'm out of clicks. Any last minute questions about the exam? So either tonight or tomorrow, you'll get notification that will come out of Engage. It will come into your email inbox that will say that the exam number one has changed. I will be putting a date in that's equal to Saturday. You have at some point during the day between 8 a.m. and 11:59 p.m. to give me an hour to take the exam. It will not take you more than an hour because you only have 60 minutes to do it. Although, truth be told, it usually takes the students about 45 minutes or so to finish the exam. And as Iwika can tell you, they're not that bad. Right? Not that bad. If there's anything you think of, send me an email, all right?
I have a quick question. Actually,
yes.
Extra credit. Can I just give you textbook answers in the same textbook?
Well, yeah. Well, you're going to answer it from the textbook.
All right. I just didn't know if you wanted like my own words.
Well. I mean, obviously, don't copy and paste, but yeah. Take care, gentlemen. We'll see you.